What's up, Monster Kids? You staying up way too late watching Bela Lugosi and Vincent Price on TV? Well, I've got the podcast for you. Cobwebs, a gothic cinema podcast in which I, Daniel Epler, and a rotating panel of guests dive into the history of the gothic horror genre and its influence on cinema today.
Now, before the party begins, let's go over the details.
I'm talking Hammer Horror, Universal Monsters, Edgar Allan Poe, and even the modern stuff that draws inspiration from those.
There are dark corners. Horror is almost impossible to imagine.
So if you've always felt you'd be a little more at home in a Transylvanian castle with the vampires in the crypt, then head to cobwebspodcast.com or check us out on major podcasting platforms. Cobwebs, a gothic cinema podcast guaranteed to give you the spooks.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to another special episode of the Dead Ringers podcast, live from Fantastic Fest 2019. My name is Noel McBride, and I'm happy to be joined by the same Fantastic Fest crew that's been with me the whole time, and that is Kat Adams, Paul Farrell, and Emily Von Zela. We're almost wrapping up here. We're on day 7, but still going strong. Not a lot of time, a lot of movies to talk about, so we're just going to get straight to it. So the first thing we saw on day 7, or Kat, Emily, and I, was The Other Lamb, which all I knew was it was a cult thing.
That's all I knew.
That's all I knew, too, and I liked it a lot. We saw a lot of slower movies, or deliberately paced movies, at Fantastic Fest this year, and this was one of them, but it still was fun to watch. It had good payoff. The cast was really good, I felt. Mm-hmm. And it is a cult movie, but it's a little different in that, well, Nolan, if you want to talk about sort of what you're...
Oh, yeah, like, the whole thing I said about was, like, for me, it's like when I go into a cult movie, usually there's, like, a mystery in it for me. It's, like, either, like, what's the cult about, or, like, why did the person end up in the cult and all this, and this is, like, not really concerned with that as much. Like, there's... It's part of the story, but it's not, like, the point of the story. It has a very specific theme and message, I think, it is, like, dealing with, and I think that's the point of it. So, like, yeah, don't expect, I expect a wild cult climax, if that makes sense. But this is more just about, like, what it's, like, the sort of story it's telling.
Yeah, it works as a metaphor, at least I felt, for women in art or any creative endeavor or leadership, essentially just... women in authority of any sort, because the cult is all women with one man leading them, and he's the shepherd, and he's not doing just a knock-up job of it, all things told. So it's sort of this next generation of women coming up in the cult and deciding what they want for themselves. And I think if you watch it through that lens, it's really powerful, or at least it was for me. It was very also cathartic. You get a good payoff at the end.
Yeah, I agree. And I think that the pacing kind of fed into that payoff I thought it was interesting that when we get to the end, the payoff isn't big.
Again, like, you're saying that, like, I wouldn't even call it a slow burn, because a slow burn implies you get to the end and there's something big.
Yeah.
And so, like...
And something big does happen, but it mostly happens off-screen.
And also, like, the way it's delivered in the narrative is, like, it sort
it's
of
not
under,
linear.
Almost undercut itself in a way that you're, like, you almost think it's a dream, and then when you realize it happens, like, a minute later, you're like, oh, that was a really clever way to do that.
It was.
Because it wasn't about that act, it was about... Like them,
what
like
meant.
You were saying,
yeah,
like,
it was about everything else.
Yeah.
And I don't think it's too much of a spoiler. And also, like, I feel like this movie might get hurt by word of mouth as far as, again, being slow and not having, like, a big mystery. So, like, we'll just say, like, the thing that you, I think, Kat, you brought up after the movie is, like, there's, like, a specific line about, like, only the shepherd can tell stories. And, like, it's just, again, like you were talking about, sort of, like, especially in creative endeavors, like, only the man's allowed to do it. And then, like, the movie is sort of out.
And if a woman's allowed to do it, it's because she's given permission.
Yeah.
Yes. And I think we've had enough of that. So it's also a really beautiful movie.
Mm-hmm.
The art direction's really nice. Yeah, I liked it a lot.
Yeah. And it's got Michael, I never know how to say his name, Huisman, also being returning as a cult leader, like, from The Invitation. So he's very good in this role, being like, I naturally have a sympathy for him because I like him and everything he's been in, but, like, also just being, like, a real dick underneath all of it. And yeah. So, like, that he gets that, like, dichotomy well.
He also has amazing hair.
Yeah.
Yes. He has really good hair in this film.
Hair, great wind in the movie.
Yeah.
His hair does a lot of acting.
It does.
What were you going to say?
There's also some great sheep that do some really
good acting work. Oh, my God, that one sheep. Yes. Yes.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Good stuff.
Yeah. And then after that, you guys saw Keep Me Company?
Keep Me Company.
Which I still don't really know how to talk about.
Yeah, it's very abstract. Another slower paced film. It was from Portugal. And it's about a couple, two women, who are meeting at this house to sort of have a clandestine meetup. Maybe the relationship's not going great. Maybe there's some things they need to work through to varying degrees of success. And then there's a pool that is also a character in this film. It was interesting that we were lucky enough to talk to the director in a Q&A after it, and that helped a lot sort of unpack what it was about. And it worked for me, actually. I liked it a lot. I thought it said some interesting things about how fissures show up in your relationship that make communication different, and how people can be occupying the same place during the same time and have very different experiences. And sometimes that's what fractures a relationship. There is only one really clear scare in the whole film, and it's towards the end, but it worked for me. I just about jumped out of my seat. I thought it was very effective. And it's really heavy on the symbolism and the allegory. So everyone's mileage may vary. The director did say it was about the dissolution of one of his relationships. And he chose to make it about women because he's not really interested in filming men, which was also interesting because it didn't feel male gazey. It just happened to be about two women in a chatty pool.
Okay. Okay. The pool is getting more interesting as the time goes on.
Yeah. And a pump. And
the pool is one of the more fascinating elements, but it is also one of the most difficult to kind of pin down and describe.
The director said he used the pool as the central symbol for this relationship because, you know, if you're multiple people are in a pool, you're all in the same place. But if someone's beneath the water and someone's above the water, they hear different things, they experience it differently, and it's a very different encounter for both of those people, even though they're doing the same thing in the same place. So that's sort of, if you move out from there, I think that's helpful. He uses a lot of color to communicate things. Like, the characters are almost always dressed in either red or black. I asked him about using red in the film, and he was basically just like, women, menstruation,
That is kind of what he said.
To think about the house itself as a woman, I think. So it's just a very feminine movie made by a man, but it doesn't feel exploitive in that way at all. Yeah, it was just interesting.
Mm-hmm.
I thought there was, at the beginning, I was worried that I'd gotten myself into something. I was going to fall asleep. But around the third act, it rallied, and I enjoyed it quite a bit. I think there's also something there about domesticity versus living a life of passion. Yeah, you'll have to see it and decide for yourself. Not sure what to tell you.
Is that a little Miss Dalloway? Is that a little Miss Dalloway?
There could have been a little Miss Dalloway.
Okay. I think it's the first time we brought up Miss Dalloway in the podcast.
I actually thought about Miss Dalloway a lot when we watched Prey, because we have the predatory older woman and the young naive woman, and then the giant knife, which are all images in Mrs. Dalloway.
Yeah.
But anyway.
What do you think of Keep Me Company, Emily?
Everything that Kat said. Okay. But not articulated as well. I thought it was really, yeah, it's interesting. No, I think everybody is going to come away with it with something a little bit different just because it is so abstract in its storytelling, and it's not going to be for everybody because the plot is so slow. But I think that he does a lot with symbolism, and he leaves the audience with a lot to unpack at the end. And going back to the pool as a character and as the imagery, he also incorporated a lot of really great sound design and went from the sound being very clear to being very muted to kind of being somewhere in between. And it's always shifting, which made it really interesting to watch or listen to, I guess.
And which also sounds like it, again, having not seen it, reflects what you were saying about going up beneath and above the pool, like the different things you hear. So yeah, the fact that he actually reflects that in the filmmaking sounds cool.
Yeah.
And then the last thing I think you saw before, I think a big one we saw later, you saw The Long Walk finally.
Emily. Yes.
And?
Oh, I loved it so much. It was really good. It took probably about 30 minutes for the pieces to kind of start falling into place in a way that made narrative sense. So mm-hmm. At first I'm like, I don't think I'm getting it. But then I really did. And it's just a beautiful story, and it's heartbreaking in some ways and really reaffirming in others. And it was a really personal story to the director, Maddie Doe, and listening to her talk about it was amazing. And yeah, I think it's one of my favorites. I'm glad you guys talked it up so much.
Yeah. I agree too. Like the first 30 minutes, like, is weird. Like I enjoyed watching it, even if like, I didn't feel like there's a whole lot going on. I feel like that one, this is the year of that vapes broke big at Fantastic Fest. There's a lot of characters like now, like I have no issue, whatever. It's fine. It was just interesting to see like how prominent it was in a couple movies now. Or just that, like, we've gotten over that hump of people being like, oh, vapes, right?
And I think it was trying to integrate the idea of technology.
Yeah, yeah. And so, like, it was just like, also, I've never seen someone look as cool using it. Like, this old man is the coolest fucking dude ever, and he's just like...
he looks like a fucking dragon.
He's like, he made vapes look cool, man. So
part of me wondered if that was like, it was supposed to be imagery because it was so evocative of something mysterious and ethereal and monstrous, and
yeah, or like almost supernatural, like again a little bit super, like sort of a fusion between supernatural and sci-fi. So yeah, very cool.
And I wouldn't even say the first 30 minutes are slow. It's just it throws you in to it and doesn't explain itself for a while.
Yeah, yeah. Like you're watching the story, but you're really not connecting what the pieces are and what's really important, because it's all just kind of happening on the same level. Nothing is calling itself out as, oh, remember this for later, or this is an important plot point. We're just kind of there absorbing it.
Yeah. And I also think it's, for me, like the biggest strength of the movie is really like the direction, because like I was saying, like, there's not a, I mean, it's just, again, you're not fully engaged with what's going on in the first 30 minutes, because, like, it's just, it's a little slower and it's just building things up, but, like, I like watching all of it. I like watching everything that happens in this movie, even when it's slow, because, like, I don't know, there's just something about, like, I could just watch the old man do whatever. Like, he could just walk out up that road smoking his vape for 2 hours and I'd probably be okay with it, because he just, like, there's something, like, he has, like, a really soulful quality, and, like, he just expresses a lot in his face without also expressing a whole lot. So, like, I don't know. It's just, yeah, great. So day 7 actually ended up being one of the days where we were most split up. So while we were seeing The Other Lamb and Kat and Emily were seeing Keep Me Company, Paul, you saw a bunch of stuff earlier in the day. First thing, I think, was The True Adventures of Wolf Boy.
Yeah. I went to see that on the recommendation of Heather Wixon.
She's trustworthy.
Yes. She delivered another great recommendation, because this was one of my favorite movies of the fest. I didn't do a top 10 yet because it's very difficult for me to choose, but this would certainly be on it and it would probably be pretty high. It's a movie that sort of looks at the cruelty inherent in the world and the lack of understanding and acceptance that can manifest in it for people who are maybe different or see themselves as different, or that the world views as different. And it's about finding purpose and value internally, against the, against all odds, given the kind of pain that can be, inflicted due to being different in the first place. So it's about a boy with a condition, that sort of causes body hair to grow all over himself. So he looks akin to like an old werewolf makeup basically on him all the time. So he really does look like a werewolf from a movie, and the makeup is really good. It's, Jaden Martell again, who just keeps on showing up in movies in Fantastic Fest. And the movie is put together with like, hand-drawn interstitials that are sort of epic storybook interstitials, that depict him fighting dragons, encountering royalty, coming face to face with a mermaid, stuff like that. That kind of gives all the proceedings a fantastical edge that makes it feel like you're reading some epic fantasy novel. Even though what he's going through and what he's facing off against is very grounded for the most part. And yeah, it's about this boy who has learned to hate the world, has learned to be cruel to other people as well as himself, because he's just given up hope that he's ever going to really fit in or be accepted. He has sort of love in his life by way of his father, who they do a really good job of quickly showing that he spends a lot of time and effort trying to help his son, you know, venture into the world, not be so afraid of it and face that discrimination head on. But his methods aren't really working or getting through to his son. And based on a letter the boy receives, it prompts him to go on a journey to try to find his estranged mother. And that's kind of the catalyst for the film. And along his journey, he encounters other people who, for different reasons, are also what you might call outcasts. And man, is this movie touching, emotional, powerful, featuring people that really don't normally get to be featured in a mainstream narrative. And I don't want to go too deeply into it because, again, that would be sort of spoilery. But it's think of like a standard coming of age comedy drama, sort of teenage movie, but populated by people that don't normally get the luxury of finding themselves at the center of such a story. And I think that's one of the reasons it resonates so well right now. And it goes to some really dark places, some sad places. But overall, it's a movie that I walked out of feeling really good, and it hopeful that, you know, just because people can be cruel, it doesn't mean that the world has to be an inherently cruel place. And that, you know, loving oneself can be accomplished regardless of outside influence. I should also mention at the core of the movie is a great, pretty over the top, John Turturro performance. And he plays like a villainous, head of a circus, like a circus master that was very akin to like Pinocchio. That's what it reminded me of.
Oh, like, weird.
Yeah, like the villain in Pinocchio, you know, the guy who sort of captures Pinocchio. It kind of reminded me of that. And he's so good. Like, he's so scenery-chewing, but he's great. And he's a really cool sort of haunting presence to our young protagonist. So, yeah, when you get the chance to see this one, definitely seek it out.
Yeah, I think I joked about it when we talked about it somewhere else, but it seems like an adult or grown-up version of the book that Emily reviewed a while ago, Morgan the Miserable Vampire, which we learned is being turned into a movie. So
yay! Oh, cool.
Yeah, or awesome. Or I think as Heather compared it to like early Tim Burton, like you describing that sounds very like Pee-wee's Big Adventure or Big Fish. So
yes, for sure.
Yeah,
for sure. Has a lot of Tim Burton influence. Maybe not as dramatically visual as Burton would have been, but it's there.
Mm-hmm. And yeah, that one got a lot of positive word of mouth too, and one I had not heard of. So that's cool. Paul, I know you saw at least one other thing in the afternoon by yourself. What was that?
Yeah. Well, the next thing I saw was Trampa Infernal, which is also known as Hell's Trap.
Mm-hmm. Way better title.
Another, right. Another repertory screening, because you know me. I like going to see those old movies. This was Fantastic Fest this year thematically was celebrating Mexican cinema. And this is a sort of notorious slasher, Mexican slasher from the late 80s, 1989, I think. And yeah, it's sort of, I guess what I liked about it, I liked a couple of things, but it concerns like a group of 20-somethings. Who to me they all felt like amalgams of like Western archetypes transplanted into like rural Mexico. There was like a handsome leader guy and a pretty strong-willed girl and an overweight plucky comic relief best friend type of guy, and they all just kind of fit these weird like broad molds, and the movie has this like kind of hyper reality that they exist in, where sort of like in Sleepaway Camp, where emotions are always exaggerated, you know, where it's like when you're happy, you're really, really, really happy. When you're angry, you're suddenly really, really, really angry. Okay. And you just kind of go with that for the movie. So the first like 20 minutes or so, like it's just like them in this small town and these two guys that are constantly like betting each other that they can win at some sort of silly contest they make up. And it has like nothing to do with being a slasher movie until eventually the guy's like, I know the ultimate challenge. There's this bear on the loose. We're going to go hunt the bear, you know, in the backwoods, and whoever kills the bear first wins. And he finds this paper that says like escaped bear wreaks havoc or something. So they go to like hunt this bear, and then the bear never comes up again. And they never deal with the bear because they encounter a crazy backwoods mask clad Vietnam War vet who lives back there and obviously is not super happy about them being there. And on their way, they meet a person who sort of warns them about the kill.
Like you know, harbinger.
Right. The harbinger warns them of what's to come. And it just, it goes into slasher territory after that. And what makes the movie a little notorious is that, so the killer, so like I said, he's this, Vietnam War vet. He wears this, this mask, which like looks very real to a human face. So like at a distance in low res, it doesn't look like a mask. That's what makes it really creepy. And the mask is like of a handsome, very serious Caucasian man with like long flowing blonde hair. Mm. So it's not like a particularly, it's very creepy because of how realistic it looks, but it's not what you'd expect this guy to be wearing. And there's no real reason for him to wear it. And then he dons like crossbows and, you know, semi-automatic rifles, but he also wears a Freddy Krueger glove, like a straight up Freddy Krueger glove. So the kills are so weird because at one point he's like gunning people down, but then at other points he's like cutting their neck with his Freddy glove. It's like very, it's a very odd, you know, combination of kills and weaponry that makes the movie just bizarre and you never know what it's going to do. And it sort of breaks the mold of a run of the mill slasher. So, and then the over the top nature of the characters makes their reactions to this really fun. So anyway, it is a definitely an interesting take on sort of the subgenre, which at that point had been kind of petering out because this was the late 80s. And it feels like a new take on some of the familiar tropes, you know, the Freddy glove notwithstanding. But adds it does feel original. Yeah, right. Exactly. And I think it definitely, if you're somebody who really, really loves slashers, like I can't see you not having a great time with this movie.
Yeah. And I assume that's probably going to get some kind of release. I feel like most of the repertory stuff that was there will probably
word on the release. Yeah. I mean, nothing that I've seen is confirmed, but I would be very surprised if these weren't available soon.
Okay. Because I was looking up Prey. I know that there was a Blu-ray of it, but it looks like it's out of stock. So I wonder if there's going to be a new Blu-ray. I assume there was a new Severn Blu-ray, but I have no clue.
Yeah, I'm not 100% sure, but
okay.
Yeah, I think so. I think most of this stuff is coming out soon.
Okay.
And then the last movie that Kat, I, well, see, the last movie that Kat and I saw, but not your last one, Paul, was Sea Fever. Huh. Which we'd all gotten pretty good word of mouth from, like, the earlier part of the festival. And Paul and I had already seen one good aquatic horror, and then we just got a second one. So what'd you guys think of Sea Fever?
I loved it.
I also loved it.
Yeah. Yeah. It was, again, another one of those, like, really unexpected ones that now is, like, one of my favorites of the festival. There's like a ship is like, is it just going out for normal fishing? I forget why.
Yeah, it's set on an Irish fishing trawler, and it features a marine biology student who is sort of being kicked out of the nest by her advisor to go do actual field work. She's more comfortable in a lab on a computer constructing models, but she's there to observe the trawler's catch and look for any deviations.
Okay.
And she finds some deviations.
Yeah, yeah. They run into
They
run into trouble pretty quick as the ship sort of gets like caught on a giant creature. They're not really sure what's going on. I won't say too much more about the creature there, but like
other than it's awesome.
Yeah, it basically happens. Some of its, I assume it's its eggs. Sort of get in the ship. It's larva get into people, and it becomes like a sort of infection spreading movie and like a cabin fever sort of plot.
There's very direct references to both The Thing and Alien.
Yeah.
Which if you're going to reference something, why not reference the best?
Good calls. And yeah, like the protagonist herself, Siobhan, feels very somewhere between like a MacReady and a Ripley. So I think, yeah, people who love any of those movies will very much be into this. Although, as I sort of told Kat, for me, like, the way it wraps up everything at the end is almost like it's an anti-thing or alien movie in terms of its thematics, which is really interesting. And
I love the way it ended.
And as we said, we said on Twitter, it will probably end up being the dead ringer for The Thing. Because it also, it has enough of a, it feels like its own thing while still calling attention to the classics. So, yeah.
Yeah, no, everything you guys said holds true for me. I love aquatic horror. This was a really interesting take on something that we've seen manifest in, like you guys were saying, different movies. I really liked how it wore its influences on its sleeve, but not in a way that was distracting or felt, like a ripoff or anything along those lines. I definitely got some strong Leviathan feelings in there. It wasn't exactly like that movie.
Especially the ending.
Yeah. I really liked the sort of grounded scientific nature of the approach to the monster and how to handle it. The lead protagonist was great in that regard. She looked at everything as a scientist would, not as a victim of the creature.
Mm-hmm.
It's multiple movies in one, so it's sort of like a giant monster movie. It's also a quarantine style movie. Like, there's different elements of horror, and the movie shifts and changes as it goes, which keeps it constantly exciting. Like, it was one of those movies that felt like it was 10 minutes long because I was just constantly with it.
Mm-hmm.
Like, I never felt like the pacing was just really, really well done, really entertaining, really well acted. The effects were really good. It had a really, really good jump scare in it, which I don't normally compliment jump scares, but this one really got me.
Well, it didn't feel like it was a jump scare for the sake of a jump scare.
Right. Yeah.
It was just a very effective scare.
Exactly.
Scare.
To make sure are we talking about the same ones? Are we talking about seeing things?
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. So, no, I think it just delivered across the board for me. I agree with you guys. It was easily one of the best movies I saw this week.
Yeah. You mentioned the like scientific grounding, I think, is important too, because as much as we made the comparisons to The Thing and Alien, I think structurally the comparisons are really there. Mm-hmm. It is a much different movie in terms of its like overall feel. Like it does, like you won't go, don't go in expecting the like that type of sci-fi horror. It's very much more, like you said, grounded in science and feels like it could be potentially in our world more than I think either of those two movies do. Mm-hmm. So I think, you know, keep that in mind when you go into it and don't go in expecting just literally the second coming of The Thing. But yeah, weirdly enough, like I felt like I didn't know any of the actors except for like the two main ones. Well, the two named ones that people would know or like get the last credits, just Doug Ray Scott and Connie Nielsen, but they're both pretty good in it. And then I forget the lady who plays Siobhan, but she was really good.
And the character of Siobhan's really good. Mm-hmm. She's interesting. She's not a heroine you always see. There was a moment where she was about to do something, and I just remember thinking, she's the bravest woman I've ever seen. Like, she's great.
Yeah. And does it in a way that's not showy at all. It's just like,
she's principled
yes. and she stands by those, and it's really, yeah. And there's a lot of fun stuff about sort of science versus superstition going on in the movie. There's just a lot to chew on. It's very good.
It is good.
So, yeah, after Sea Fever, I don't think I saw anything else. But, Paul, you saw at least one more movie, didn't you?
Yeah, I saw After Midnight.
Okay. And I guess that would be the last one, because that's the midnight slot, so you couldn't have stayed for the 2 a.m. slot.
I would have been really impressed.
No, I did not stay beyond 2 a.m.
How was that?
it was great. So After Midnight was actually one of my most anticipated movies of the fest. It's written and directed by Jeremy Gardner, who I adore. He and his writing partner, Christian Stella, made The Battery, which is another sort of micro-budget movie horror film. It's a zombie film, but it's not like any zombie film you've ever seen. Wonderfully intimate, deeply felt, thinking man's zombie film. That's also like really brilliantly photographed and shot. Like the way they compose shots oftentimes are long takes that don't ever feel boring, because when they employ them, you're sort of getting in the headspace of the character. So they use it really sparsely and intelligently. Mm-hmm. Dare I say Kubrick-esque, in my opinion. I know some people might roll their eyes at that, but that's something that Kubrick would do, is that he wouldn't cut. You know, he would hold on characters for long periods of time to get into their headspace. And I think these guys do it really well. They also made a really, really funny, incredibly micro-budget movie called Tex Montana Will Survive, which my wife and I just think is hilarious, about a survivalist like host of a show, like a TV show that actually attempts to really go into the wild and survive on his own. And he gets lost and hilarity ensues. Hmm. But yeah, so knowing that he made another movie, going into it, I was very excited. Didn't know what to expect. I didn't watch a trailer. And what I got was right along those lines. It is, again, a very intimate, movie about, to me, it's a film about love, and it's about capturing it and keeping it, and the difficulties therein. And it sort of focuses on a character named Hank, played by Jeremy Gardner, who at the beginning of the film is sort of haunted by what appears to be a disintegrating relationship and hunted by something from the woods surrounding his house that comes for him at night. We never see this thing when we're first introduced to it. We hear the sounds it makes, right, as he sits up awake at night with his gun and a beer in hand. And of course, we already begin to think, is Hank sane? You know, is he imagining this? Is it a metaphor for the creature within him, and why his relationship isn't working? And as we are watching modern day Hank sort of descend into his depressed state, we flash back to the early days of his relationship with Bria Grant. And it's a really beautiful tapestry. These pure moments early on in the relationship that feel incredibly real and relatable. And the excitement of falling in love, but then cutting back to sort of the real world consequences of existence when it's shared between two people with differing priorities that don't ever make time to, you know, help those priorities coalesce or work to make them coalesce. So it's a movie that feels very human and very real, but at the same time, there's, so for all the darkness and for all the drama, there's a ridiculous amount of levity and humor. There's overt comedy at times that just comes out of nowhere that makes you laugh out loud. And again, all just playing off of the human condition and the constant fluctuation of emotions that happen to people over the course of their life. So I just thought it was a movie that, you know, plays with visceral terror, plays with existential disillusionment, relationships, what it means, what's there. And then it all comes together in a really great way that was incredibly satisfying. But I think at the end of the day, it's a movie that just sort of explores kind of what's left when what matters is gone and the hole that leaves. And to me, the thing that's coming after him sort of suggests that when there is a hole left behind, you don't know what might slip through. And so, yeah, it really resonated with me.
I was going to say the thing I feel like, because we heard a couple other people see this there, and I feel like the biggest thing that people mentioned was just how much it balanced tones and how well it did that. Like you were saying, there's a musical number and all the sort of different types of genre stuff. Makes it sound like it's sort of a unique beast.
Yeah. Cool. Yeah, definitely not much like it. So this is one that I don't know what kind of release it's going to get. But again, if you haven't seen The Battery, go watch The Battery. But this is one, too, that I think you should definitely check out.
Yeah. And some people may not be aware, but it was originally called something else. And it just got the title changed a couple months ago. So going into this festival, I think I thought that he had two movies there, like Joe Bigos. Gotcha. Just turned out it was just a title change. So,
yeah,
but that's great.
And so, yeah, that's going to do it from day 7 at Fantastic Fest. Before we go, I want to remind everyone where they can find all of our co-hosts on Twitter. Emily is at Horrorella Blog. Paul is at Paul is Great 2000. And Kat is at Bureau Kat. BUREAUKAT. And yeah, you can find me on Twitter at Nolan_McBride or the show's Twitter handle, which is at Dead Ringers Pod. You can find new episodes of Dead Ringers on iTunes, Spotify, Stitcher, Google Play, and TuneIn. If you like us, please make sure you're subscribed, leave us a rating, and definitely consider leaving us a review, as that will help us reach a bigger audience, keep growing, and do fun things like cover big film festivals in this way. Yeah, you can also find new and old episodes at deadringerspodcast.com, as well as all of our Fantastic Fest coverage. Paul has been writing up a storm reviews, and they are all collected there. And then if you want to see some of Emily's coverage, she actually covered for Daily Dead, so check out there. And yeah, so we'll be back tomorrow with the final day from Fantastic Fest. As always, if you want to keep up to date on things, keep an eye on Twitter. It's usually the best bet. Thanks to Thomas Foster for our theme and Philip Yunt for our artwork and logo. And a huge thanks to everyone for listening and sharing the show. You know, whatever way you help support the show, we really appreciate it. It means a lot to us. And yeah, as always, on behalf of my co-hosts, thanks for listening and stay spooky.